Today's episode is all about language. It's a topic that touches every aspect of who we are, from how we connect with others to how we understand ourselves, whether it's the languages we're taught in school, the ones we speak at home, or the ones we long to learn. Language is much more than a tool for communication. Language, too, has been used to shape, control, and even limit our opportunities. In education, the language we are taught in is often the language of power, the language of colonial legacies, the language of institutions, and sometimes the language of exclusion. In this episode, we'll reflect on how language can act as a tool for reproducing inequalities. How does the dominance of certain languages in education systems, especially colonial languages, affect who gets to speak, who gets heard, and who is left out? How does the imposition of a foreign language in education disconnect us from our roots, from our heritage, and from the very language that hold our stories? We'll also unpack how language can be a battleground for control, not just of knowledge, but of narratives. Whose voices are amplified, and whose voices are silenced when we operate in languages that don't reflect our realities or histories? How do we navigate a world that demands we speak a certain way, even when it doesn't speak to our true selves? To help us unravel some of these big questions, we have three guests who bring personal stories and sharp insights to the conversation. Each of them has experienced firsthand how language intersects with identity and opportunity in unique ways. One guest reflects on the privilege of speaking English and the doors it opens, but also on the guilt of knowing that access to those doors isn't shared equally. Another shares the journey of navigating education in a language that's not their own, and what it means to reconcile their sense of self with the expectations of the system. And finally, we hear about the deep ties between language and culture, and the heartbreak of watching these ties weaken when language isn't valued in education. It's a conversation about identity, equity, and the way language shapes not just our education, but our humanity. And because this podcast is part of a broader investigation, we'll also explore how preserving linguistic diversity can help us build more inclusive societies where everyone has the chance to thrive.
During my undergraduate degree, I had the opportunity to spend a semester studying abroad at the University of Stellenbosch in South Africa. Looking back, I certainly entered the experience with naivete about internationalization and the role of language as it relates to educational identity and opportunity. The move to Stellenbosch was the first time I had visited and lived in the Global South. Stellenbosch is a South African university town nestled between mountains and vineyards, and it offered an interesting microcosm where I was able to explore the intersection of language and opportunity, particularly because of the inequity that is so obviously apparent within Stellenbosch and South Africa. Stellenbosch's architecture is a constant reminder of its colonial past. The two dominating languages in the university and the city center are the Dutch language of Afrikaans and English. Thus, the languages most spoken are the languages of South Africa's colonizers. This is particularly interesting because South Africa is a diverse nation of 12 languages. Black South Africans in the region, who represent the majority population, spoke the Xhosa language. While studying at Stellenbosch, I took part in a global service learning course that placed students as teachers at a school in the neighboring Kayamadi township. We paired the teaching with lectures to discuss the experience and the broader socio-political context of Stellenbosch in South Africa. Frankly, the lessons I delivered in the class were rudimentary. They served little purpose but to introduce students to English who otherwise had very limited exposure to English. The teachers of the class had identified the need to include English in their schools, despite the fact that many of the teachers did not speak English themselves. They were cognizant of the structures in South Africa that closely tie language to opportunity. For these students to access many of the opportunities in the local business centers, they would have to learn English. The experience made me consider the potential ramifications of students being pushed to prioritize learning of a language that is not their native tongue. They are being pushed towards economic opportunity, but at what cost? When we look at South Africa at the national level and the role of language in globalization globally, it's easy to see the ways in which education is often dismissive of local language and indigenous cultures and knowledge, and how that can be detrimental to an individual's view of themselves. The Global Service Learning course emphasized the importance of cooperative discussions in education that encouraged dialogue among all stakeholders that were involved in that learning process. There is a harsh reality that links language with opportunity and often can force people to sacrifice a part of their own identity as they navigate a Eurocentric education landscape. But we have an opportunity to guide these conversations and ensure that we are not sacrificing an individual's identity, community, and encouraging the sharing of knowledge from different contexts. This is something that I took home with me. It forced me to challenge the role of language in my own education, particularly because the majority population of my secondary school were Hispanic Americans who typically spoke Spanish at home. This relationship we have with language is extremely important, and it's essential that we are challenging and considering the role of language in education. I continue to take this forward in my work.
Positive reframing, as I understand it, is the art of using language to reconfigure reality, or at least our perception of it. It's a process of nudging a negative situation into softer focus, swapping one story for another. The success of this depends on two things. First, the belief that your relationship to a situation can be rewritten by simply manipulating words. And second, the hope that this rewritten story is enough to bend reality itself. To believe in positive reframing, then, is to believe in language not just as communication, but as construction, a tool for building a world. I encountered this strategy, this belief, early in my professional life. One of my first tasks as a teacher was administering a letter recognition test to four-year-olds. My colleague, demonstrating the process, told the children not to say, "I don't know," when they came across a letter they couldn't name, but instead to say, "I don't know yet." A single three-letter word transformed the meaning of their struggle. "I don't know" is finite, a conclusion. "I don't know yet" is a narrative with room to grow, an invitation to the future. Later, I saw similar care in how the school talked about emotions. Staff were trained not to label children by their feelings. Jack is angry. But to phrase them as transient experiences, Jack is feeling angry. That small shift creates a profound difference. It framed emotions as states, not identities. Kids weren't anger itself, nor will they be trapped by an emotion. They were people temporarily passing through emotions, with the ability to leave them behind. The phrasing didn't just make emotions feel manageable. It also built a scaffold of belief. It told kids they could get through it, and that we believed they could too. Both of these examples hinge on the same premise, that language can construct reality, that by changing how we describe a child or their experience, we can alter the trajectory of their self-perception. We can help them see themselves not as fixed, static beings, but as dynamic, capable individuals with agency. It's a beautiful idea, really. And I wonder now how much of my own skepticism about it comes from the fact that I wasn't raised with that kind of language myself. When I think back to my own education, my relationship with language was purely transactional. I learned English not as a tool for self-reflection, but as a means of survival in a school where it was the only language of instruction. Words had to function. There were hammers and screwdrivers designed to meet practical, predefined, specified objectives. To write a thesis, to explain a chemical reaction, to embellish a story for higher grades. Language had a purpose, and that purpose was always outward-facing. It was about outcomes, about producing something measurable. What it was never about was the inward-facing work of using language to shape your mental or emotional landscape. That wasn't an explicit goal of the curriculum, and because it wasn't part of the curriculum, I had never developed such a language toolkit. That absence feels, now, like a loss. The mental and emotional strength to face adversity doesn't materialize out of thin air. It's cultivated, modeled, taught. And yet, so often, schools focus on the measurable, the outcomes we can test and quantify, while the intangible, resilience, hope, the belief in one's ability to overcome is left to chance. Resilience, I've come to believe, isn't just a virtue, it's a necessity. It's the capability that underpins every other functioning, as the human capability approach would put it. Without resilience, wellness falters, and without wellness, every other functioning, learning, creating, connecting, leading, crumbles. Resilience is what makes hope sustainable. And if resilience is teachable, and I think it is, then schools should be teaching it with the same urgency as math or science. The stakes couldn't be higher. Without mental and emotional resilience, how can we expect anyone to face the world's overwhelming challenges? Climate crisis, polarization, inequality, and still believe in change. Resilience isn't just about bouncing back. It's about the courage to try in the first place, to see possibility where others see despair. And for that courage to grow, we need an education system that values wellness as much as knowledge, that teaches kids how to reframe adversity, how to hold on to hope, how to believe in their own agency even when the odds are against them. I can't seem to believe this myself. My skepticism, my tendency to feel trapped by circumstance rather than empowered by it, is a failure. A failure of language, perhaps, or of the system that shaped my language. But what I can't do for myself, I hope the next generation can learn to do. They deserve an education that equips them not just to survive, but to lead, to change, to rebuild. If resilience can be taught, then we owe it to them and to the future to teach it. Because the world doesn't need more cynics like me. It needs believers.
Bạn có nói được tiếng Việt không? The professor at the National University of Vietnam asked me during my research assistantship interview this question. It's a simple one. Can you speak Vietnamese? Yet it carried the weight of every language choice I'd ever made. Standing there, my response caught in my throat. Well, yes, I spoke Vietnamese, but not the academic Vietnamese expected in a university setting. My Vietnamese was the language of my grandfather's stories and family meals, while my academic thoughts flowed in Czech and English, a product of Prague school system and years of Western education. And this moment still echoes as I observe EAP classrooms at Vietnamese universities. Last summer, I watched a student hesitate before sharing her research on environmental sustainability. Can I explain it in Vietnamese first? She asked. And the teacher nodded, and suddenly her ideas flowed freely, her passion evident. And as she switched between Vietnamese and English, her classmates leaned in, engaged not despite the language mixing, but because of it. This linguistic tension reveals something deeper about education colonial legacies. When that student asked to explain in Vietnamese first, she was unconsciously challenging what scholars call the linguistic hierarchy, a system where Western languages, particularly English, are positioned as inherently more academic or valuable. And this isn't just about language choice, it's about who gets to define what counts as knowledge and how it should be expressed. Now think back to your own education. Remember that moment when a complex idea finally clicked? For me, it happened in multiple languages. During my IB years, I grappled with business theories in English, processed them through Czech frameworks I'd learned earlier, and often explained them to my dad in Vietnamese. And each language offered a different lens, a unique way of seeing what pro-structuralist theorists call the constructed nature of knowledge. But here's the challenge facing education systems worldwide. How do we balance the push for global language skills with the need to maintain linguistic diversity? In Vietnamese universities, I've seen this tension play out daily. A professor struggles to articulate complex theories of post-colonialism in English, exemplifying what development theories call dependency relationship in education, where Western models of academic discourse are imposed regardless of local context, And so a Hmong student brilliantly would explain traditional agricultural practices in her mother tongue, only to fall silent when asked to present in Vietnamese. And it's a stark example of how language policies can either enable or suppress what educators term epistemic pluralism. And these aren't just communication issues. They're sustainability challenges that reflect deeper neoliberal tensions in education. When we prioritize one language at the expense of others, we create what I've observed as linguistic fault lines in education. And during my undergrad research, I saw how these fault lines can fracture learning communities. A student raises her hand in class. "Well, teacher, I know the answer, but I don't know how to say it in English." If a parent stops attending school meetings, their valuable insights are lost because they can't express them in the dominant language. But I have also seen solutions emerging. At the National University of Vietnam, some departments are experimenting with what they call language flexible learning, a decolonial approach that challenges traditional power structures in education. Students discuss concepts in whatever language best serves their understanding and then work collectively to develop academic expression in both Vietnamese and English. Now, this approach recognizes what human development theorists call the capability approach, focusing on expanding people's real freedoms to achieve well-being. And the results are really striking. In these classrooms, participation rates are higher, complex ideas flow more freely, and students develop not just bilingual skills, but what one teacher called linguistic confidence, the ability to navigate between languages without the fear of judgment. This exemplifies what social ecological theorists describe as positive interactions across multiple systems, from individual cognition to classroom dynamics to even broader societal structures. Now, currently at UCL, I'd like to research how these approaches could scale sustainably. The challenge isn't just about teaching languages. It's about creating educational spaces where multiple languages can thrive together, challenging the neoliberal emphasis on individual success over collective well-being. Now, critics often say that this is impractical and too resource intensive, or they might say English is the global language and we're doing students a favor by immersing them in it. But this view misses something crucial. Language isn't just a skill to be learned, it's a tool for learning itself. It reflects what human rights scholars call the right to education in its fullest sense, including the right to learn in ways that honor one's linguistic and cultural heritage. Let me share a scene from a classroom as an example. A group of students were struggling with a complex problem in their English medium class. The breakthrough came when I said, "Explain it to each other in Vietnamese first, then we'll develop the English terminology together." And within minutes, the room would buzz with understanding. Students weren't just translating, they were demonstrating what post-colonial theorists call knowledge democracy, which is the idea that understanding can and should flow through multiple linguistic channels. So the challenge ahead is clear. How do we build education systems that sustain not just language skills, but the human capacity for multilingual thinking? The answer, I believe, lies in recognizing that every language a student brings to the classroom is a resource for learning, not an obstacle to overcome. And as we work toward truly sustainable education, let's remember, the goal isn't just to teach languages, but to create spaces where all languages can teach us something new. In the end, a sustainable development in education means ensuring every student can speak, think, and learn in the languages that make them whole. A vision that encompasses both individual agency and collective well-being.